Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Here we are again in the kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together once a week here at this fine community radio station to talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions.
Oh, and boy, are we opinionated.
We do. You'll hear a lot of
things. But we're right, aren't we, Lana?
I think that's what a being opinionated
yes,
means.
Yes,
yeah, of course, of course. And this is a community radio station. Most of us are volunteers. Lots of things going on here. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Support for Donalana Kitchen comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Well, thanks for being with us today on the Donalana Kitchen. We have got a fine show for you.
We think it might be the last hot summer day.
Oh,
is it hot?
Well, we still have all of September to go through.
Yes, yes. You never know.
We had Labor Day. It was a beautiful bunch of days all around leading up to Labor Day, and actually I labored on Labor Day. I had some potatoes to pick up, but then I celebrated Labor Day with a bubble bath. So that wasn't too bad. I had a good Labor Day.
Yes, I don't know. You know what my favorite gardening tool is? The pruning saw.
You've been at it, haven't you?
Yes, I did. I was out bushwhacking. You know, all that rain, I didn't really go out and look at the yard because I didn't have to water. Maybe it was a whole month. All of a sudden, it is like a jungle out there.
Actually, it's kind of nice that the earth does that to us.
If it was
left up to us, we'd never get around to creating all that bounty.
Well, I had to chop in a few places because otherwise you'd like start getting poked in the eye getting into the front door or something, you know.
That's true. Interacting with our environment.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, also this last weekend, there was an earthquake.
Yes.
There was an earthquake.
It kind of shimmied all the way up from Oklahoma.
That's what I heard. And according to the timing, I was in the car at the time driving to Farmer's Market.
So you wouldn't have felt it.
I didn't feel it. But people came to Farmer's Market kind of wide-eyed and sort of talking fast, saying, did you feel that? And I said, I didn't know what I felt. No, I had a Farmer's Market customer that said yes as she was sitting there eating her breakfast. Her little hanging light above her kitchen kind of wiggled, and she figured that's what it was.
Well, you know, the first time, because I lived in California for many years, I have some earthquake experience. The first time I felt one, you don't really know what it is. It's sort of like, you know, when you're in the car and a big truck drives by you and it kind of goes, woo!
Yeah.
Just a little wobble from the air pressure. It's kind of that's what an earthquake feels like, I think. I mean, to me.
Oh, dear.
It's not too startling.
Oh, dear. I wish they would quit fooling around with things under the earth. Because
you know,
it was shaking things up here.
You know that those Oklahoma earthquakes are caused by fracking. This is not really, there's no other explanation for it.
Yeah.
It's pretty well established that we're disturbing the underground so much that sort of Mother Nature is ruffling her skirts at us.
Something to put in your pipe and puff on there. So let's think about that, folks. So today on the Donalana Kitchen, well, put earthquakes in the back of your mind. Today we're going to be considering cows and sheep and food. And I have a little some thoughts on elderberries and we'll have some thoughts of other things, too. You know, it's always good to keep up with new technology. We have a special guest here in the studio, Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Yes, Megan Filbert is the livestock coordinator at PFI, and she has a few things that we're interested in talking about. So welcome, Megan.
Thank you for having me, Lana and Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
You came to my farm. We see each other every now and then during the week, and you told me about a PFI field day that you had been on. You were all excited. Those field days are usually very good things. And you told me about, I guess it isn't all that new, but I had never heard about it, robotic milking for cows. So tell me, is this true, Megan?
Yes, it is true. And it's happening in Iowa, as well as other parts of the country. But in late...
So you've actually seen this?
Yeah, so we... 60 people saw it in late August. We, PFI, had a field day at Laura Jones and her father Steve Leisure's farm, which is in Cedar County, close to the Mississippi River, eastern Iowa. There's not too many dairies left in that area, but I heard from Steve, the farm host. He told me that there are at least 25 dairies in Iowa with robots milking cows, and
wow,
there could be potentially up to 50 or so.
I'm shocked.
I am just fascinated. First off, I had no idea. Second off, how does this work?
Yeah, what's it look like?
Yeah, so as best I can explain it over the air, basically, cows walk in a single file line. They walk into a little pen. It's not really a stanchion. It's just kind of a feeding station. And on one side of that pen or station, there's a robotic arm. And this arm has lasers on it. And those lasers are able to detect each teat of the udder. And they then proceed to clean the udder and clean the teats, wipe them down with iodine, do all of the pre-milking.
Wait, how did they get the cow to stand in the right place?
So the cow...
Is this like scanning your book at the library where you have the barcode? And...
Actually, the cow has a chip in its ear,
in its ear tag.
And that chip then knows exactly which cow it is, and it lets down the correct amount of feed for each cow, depending on her weight and her milk production.
All right, so she's already standing in the right place.
That's right.
Just like they used to automatically go, cows know to go to the stanchion that's theirs.
Exactly.
Right.
So each cow comes in, and it stands in the correct place, the feed is let down, and then gates are closed for her milking time. So she can't back up or go move forward during the milking.
So it is like a stanchion in that way.
Somewhat, yes, yes. So... as she's eating, this robotic arm is put to work, and it is cleaning the udder, and then it prepares for milking, and then it actually starts to milk. So
I'm sorry, but I'm imagining a Walt Disney cartoon where the hand comes down with the Mickey Mouse glove on it, has a sponge in it, feels around the udder, and then snaps the thing on.
It's like that, but just a little more computerized and technical.
Good. So, I hope there's a little bit of humor in it.
Good. Yes. It's really fascinating to watch, and it sounds scarier than it actually looks when you're watching the robot milk the cow. It's almost like therapeutic, and you can tell that the cow is actually it's working very well for this cow. Laura did tell me that the absolute best part of having this robotic milker is that it milks the cow the same way every single time.
Oh.
Which a human may or may not do.
Okay.
So really,
that's a good
cows
thing.
Love consistency.
Okay. Oh.
All animals love consistency and routine, especially dairy cows. So therefore, the consistency of this robotic milker is...
So that's like consistency of pressure.
Exactly.
Timing.
All of those things. Exactly. So it's the actual act of milking... Sucking the milk from the teat with like a vacuum suction is the same, like
as
it would be.
As a milk machine.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. It's a milk machine, but it's attached to its robotic arm. And the other really fascinating thing about this technology is that there's a computerized system that is measuring the milk output from each quarter of the udder. So you can actually read milk output from each teat, which is something that you can't do with just modern.
All right. If a teat is not producing as much, does that clue you into like maybe there's
mastitis?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So.
Wait. We better say what mastitis is.
And mastitis is really just an infection of the teat. Usually the teat end. It's a bit of bacteria that may get up into the teat and then cause an inflammation, which then causes. Well, for one, it hurts the dairy cow to be milked, and two, it causes some extra cells to be present in the milk, which is affects milk quality. It degrades milk quality, mm-hmm, so we don't mm-hmm. want that. So
plus they can get sick and sick and sicker if you don't catch it.
Exactly. So
it's not good.
It is. We are able to detect mastitis in one teat or maybe more, and not milk that teat and treat it right away as soon as we possibly see any sort of difference in observation with that computer technology.
So does that mean somebody sitting watching the screens instead of the cows?
Well, so you're kind of doing both. You are able to watch the computer as the robot is milking. Mm-hmm. You can also get readouts after milking any time during the day. You can go to your computer and get readouts on these cows. The other thing is they're also wearing an activity monitor, which Laura described as a Fitbit for cows.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And so she'll know when a cow is not being as active, and maybe that means that cow's getting sick. So she can go into the barn and then observe that specific cow and pay more closer attention to that cow before she would have known anything is up. There's also times when the activity monitor is showing more activity than normal, and that would mean to the farmer that your cow's in heat potentially, or it's pasture season and your cows are out on pasture and just getting more exercise in that way. So it's pretty cool to think about and to be able to monitor your cows in this way. And so because this robot can be very consistent with its milking, you're getting higher milk quality. So there's...
Does that mean lower bacterial
that's
counts?
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. It means lower bacterial counts.
That's good for all of us.
So they measure this as somatic cell count. And
you want to say what a somatic cell
sure,
is?
Sure. All cows give off somatic cells. They're always present in the milk, but you want that count to be as low as possible. And under 500,000 is good.
Wait,
sounds like a lot.
What's a somatic cell?
It's, I believe it is a part of the white blood cells, I believe, that are just present in the milk, that are basically cells that are sloughing off mm-hmm. Through the teats into our milk. And over a certain level, they're of concern, but under a certain level, no problem.
So somatic cell count also gives a view of the health of the animal.
That's right.
So if the animal's having some kind of minor low-level infection, the somatic cell count will go up. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So when there's mastitis on the teat, or when the teat end is injured in some way and there's a bit of infection and inflammation, you know, all of our good cells that are healing are rushing to that site to heal, and you're going to see more presence of cells sloughed off into the milk, indicating there's some sort of inflammation and infection that's being healed. Mm-hmm. So Laura said that since they got the robot, which they started milking robotically about 16 months ago.
Okay, wait. How many cows are they milking?
So they milk 60 cows.
60 cows with one robot?
With one robot. So
how much does a robot cost?
Yeah, she said everything with all of the bells and whistles, the gates, the computers, it cost $260,000. So it's quite expensive, and one robot can handle about max 65 cows. So if they want to increase their herd, they have built in the space to actually put in another robot.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, the cows are self-feeding, and they stand in line. How do you convince a cow to do this?
Well, because there's feed there for it.
Oh, all right.
And because... What Lana is saying is that the cows basically are milking themselves. And they're milking themselves whenever they feel like they want to be milked.
So it's not like twice a day they line up?
No, it's any time over the 24 hours of the day.
So they learn They unlearn coming in twice a day, and they learn to just come when
That's
the
right.
pressure happens?
Laura did say that for the first 3 weeks, it was kind of chaotic in the barn while the cows were learning because they love a routine. They love consistency, so it threw them off. But eventually, now, new cows on the farm, you know, fresh heifers that are now being milked for the first time, they get the hang of it from watching other cows.
It seems to me curious because the cows have been trained for so long to come in at a certain time, and so they don't just, like, all line up and wait for this one milker?
She said at certain times of the day, and depending on milk productivity. So potentially, if you had a pasture-based system in the middle of the summer when there's really lush grass, they're going to have a lot of milk to release. So there may be periods of the day when there is a line waiting for the milker.
Well, they can probably all take a number or something. You know?
Exactly.
Stand in line, yeah. Chew their cud.
Yes.
They wait. Well, but they are sort of herd-oriented. They're used to all doing everything at the same time.
Right.
So it's not like one of them will say, oh, gee, I'm really feeling full, and she'll amble in by herself and
she
plug
may,
up.
And then others will follow.
They'll think, oh, me too?
And I've seen, when we were there in August, there was one cow at a time, and there wasn't a line. And it may just been the time of the day or the season. But I've also seen other robotic dairies where there is a line of about five cows waiting. So it's really interesting to think about because it's kind of, in a way, closer to mimicking nature than milking a cow twice a day.
Because the babies usually
exactly.
have at it all
I've
the
heard
time.
That calves naturally will suckle seven times a day for very short intervals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's almost letting that cow relieve herself in that way
mm-hmm.
whenever she feels it.
So given the option, how often are cows coming in to be milked?
Yeah. So Laura said that the average on their farm is 2.2 times a day.
Okay.
Some cows spike that average, and they're at three times a day or more, and some cows are around 1.8. But on average, the cows are still milking themselves
mm-hmm.
2.2
mm-hmm.
times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it does depend on if they have access to pasture in the summer or if they're in the barn during the winter because they have a farther way to walk in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're hanging out outside a little bit more. Or if it's a really hot day, maybe they're actually coming inside to have some shade and they'll milk themselves more often.
Okay, so for the farmer, obviously they're getting all these important metrics and sort of things. But does that mean, for example, they don't have to get up on Sunday morning at, you know, 5:30 a.m.
Exactly.
More like 3.
So, Laura,
tell me about the impact on dairy farmers that
and
now
quality
have
of life
on
yeah.
the people.
Yes. So, Laura did tell us that she, when she was milking without a robot, she was milking at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m.
Oh.
And mm-hmm. after she had her third child, it was just almost impossible. She basically said she was not being a very nice person to people she'd encounter during the day.
Stress, yes.
Yes.
That
tired
happens
and
when
stress.
You have three children, even without cows.
So the amazing thing about this robotic milking is the flexibility it gives the farmer. It doesn't mean that there's less labor. It means that the type of labor shifts. Your management shifts. So you actually spend more time observing cows or maybe tinkering with fixing up the machine or the computer instead of actually hands-on milking the cows. So you're still working basically just as hard. It's just a more flexible schedule with more observation time of your animals.
Right. I assume that there is a robotic milking tech number you can call, because if this goes down, this is not good for
exactly.
the cows.
They do have a backup generator, but yes, their nearest tech person is 45 minutes away. So that's always something to consider, because I've been on some farms. This was in upstate New York, which is a big dairy state, that were transitioning over to robots or wanted to, but realized that the nearest tech person was 2 hours away. So they thought, they didn't want to do it.
Risky, yeah.
What we do see now, as robots become more popular in the dairy industry, there's more and more service available, more and more tech people, and the price is coming down.
Well, but what kind of backup do you, what do you do? Get out the milk pail and the stool if it all fails and start doing it all manually?
Good question. I think
you've got to have a backup.
Yeah. I think that would probably be, like, down the list on what they would do. They still have their old parlor. It's probably not completely functioning, but I'm sure that they could rig up some sort of, like, portable mobile milking unit into a milking bucket if they have to. But they did say they have the backup generator and that a tech person's able to come.
But that's only the electrical part.
That's right, yeah. You know. A tech person's able to come in 45 minutes, and they'll do that around the clock. And at this point, Laura said she's getting really good with troubleshooting all of the little finicky things that happen with the technology. And she maintains it a little bit every day, and it's performed very, very well. So they feel it's reliable.
Well, this when you think about it, this isn't such a huge leap because we're already dealing with automatic milk machines and milking parlors and bulk tanks. I mean, a lot of stuff has been automated, but this is a big change as far as timing for the farmer and milking for the cows. They can be on their own schedule.
Yeah. How can you finance something that large on a 60-cow dairy?
Yeah, good question. So,
I mean, that's a major, major investment.
Yeah, Laura did say that now they used to have someone full-time there to help milk. They had a full-time employee. Now they have one woman who works, like, 10 hours a week, so 20 hours every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. just maybe for some relief milking and to do some chores. So they're saving, she said they're saving about $15,000 to $30,000 a year in not having that full-time employee. Mm-hmm. And she just, over years, that cost will hopefully pay for itself. So they felt with, saving money and paying another employee and quality of life was worth the investment.
We're talking about robotic milking on the farm. It's a new thing, but it's not a brand new thing. It's been around. Cows are learning new things, and we can, too. You're listening to KHOI. This is Donalena Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We are back. This is the Donalena Kitchen. We are around the kitchen table with Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa talking about cows and milk cows and milk and robotic milking systems. They're actually, when you think about it, getting that milk out of the cow into our coffee in the morning is a long process.
Complex.
So there's a lot of concerns. Donna was mentioning some concerns, perhaps, that one would have.
You know, I grew up in dairy farming families, and this whole thing, I can certainly see the convenience of it. I mean, you know, my uncles all had, you know, the normal milking machines that by the time I was growing up carried into the lines right into the cooler in the milk room and stuff like that. So it sort of makes sense to me. But I'm not a Luddite. But let me tell you, a little thing happened to me last summer. A month ago, actually. My on-demand water heater, my very fancy high-tech, you know, supposed to be the latest in bells and whistles, and it was only 3 years old, stopped producing hot water. So I call the company, local company I bought it from, you know, very reliable, friendly. They come right over. The young man goes through it. Oh, I think it's the bore. Oh, dear, I have to order a part. Okay, so the part didn't come. I'm 10 days into it and still no part. Finally, you know, after, you know, the dishes have been piled up and I've been taking cold showers. Thank goodness it was hot out. The part shows up. So they come. They go put it in. And lo and behold, it wasn't that part. We have to order another part. At this point, I'm like, this feels like a third world country. We can't get a part in the middle of Iowa for an American-made piece of equipment. It took 12 days of no water. So that's just a, I mean, no, I had water. I had hot, cold water. But that kind of fault, if you get it in something like a system where you're 60 cows, what are you going to do? I mean, it sounds scary to me.
It is scary, actually. It's a good question, and I don't know how every farmer would specifically handle it, but you can always resort to using your hands and hand milking.
Hand milking for 60 cows is a big deal.
It's a big deal. It'd be a huge deal.
Yeah, can you imagine if the dairy was any larger than that?
Right, and there are plenty of larger dairies, and that's considered
sure.
a really small dairy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, think about disasters happen. There's floods. There's tornadoes. There's all kinds of things, and like you were talking about earlier, on the other end of the weather scale, there are snowstorms, and the milk bulk truck can't get to your farm. For those of us who are sitting here with our coffee cup with the cream in it, yes, somebody has to get the milk from the farm to the milk processing plant, and that usually is a guy in a truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of, there's been several times where roads have washed out in floods, and there's no way a milk truck can get to your farm to pick up your milk out of your bulk tank. And in that case, farms just have to dump their milk. Where they dump it, I'm not exactly sure, but it's about, who knows, it's thousands of pounds of milk at any one time.
But milk is considered a good fertilizer.
That is true, actually.
It doesn't hurt if
that
you have to
true.
Jump in it. I mean, it's a loss, but the worst loss would be if you can't milk the cows. You don't want to lose the cows.
That's right.
That's
the cows
the
need
critical.
The relief, yes.
Yeah, you have to, cows must be milked.
Yes, they must be milked.
Livestock is an amazing sort of commitment from anyone who wants to raise dairy cows or beef cattle or pigs, or there's all kinds of things. And you're involved with other things besides dairy cows, right?
Yes, I am.
Oh, yes. Lana and Megan have an ongoing experiment. Ladies, do tell us about this.
Yes, I am currently raising 3 sheep at Lana and Joe's farm.
Which, for fun, right?
It's for fun, but really the primary goal is for soil health. Really, so Lana and Joe have a vegetable farm, and they have about 3 to 4 acres of just some pasture, clovers, grasses that's just kind of grows, and there's nothing done with it every year.
This is on the creek bottom?
No, just in between everything.
Oh,
some's on the creek bottom.
There's lots of in-betweens.
Exactly. Kind of the border
pathways.
Areas of the vegetable garden and down by the creek. And so they were really thinking about, let's get a ruminant animal in here, an animal that can eat grass.
Megan, I have to tell you, I was lobbying for pigs, but...
Well, pigs wouldn't do quite the same.
No, I think sheep are great.
Yes.
Good idea.
I'm also lobbying for pigs there. But we started with the sheep, one species at a time.
How did you talk Joe into this?
I didn't need to talk him into it very much. He was all for it because they had told me they had sheep there 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And basically, they wanted someone that was really interested in sheep that would come out a few times a week and check on them and feed them and move them around. With fencing.
Sounds like a low labor for Joe and Lana.
And in turn, they would keep an eye on them every day. Well, because I live in town and they're about 10 miles away. So it's really a win-win between both of us because we're getting more fertility into the soil. And the sheep we're fattening the sheep up and we're going to have a big lamb roast and party in November.
Yum, yum.
Yes.
What kind of sheep are they?
So they're Katahdin sheep. Which means that they are a hair sheep breed. Now, hair sheep are actually becoming really popular for meat production, for lamb, because they don't need to be shorn. They actually molt or shed their fiber, their fur. And right now, it's been hot, so you can tell that they're wanting to shed a bit.
Yeah, they're looking pretty sheddy right now.
Exactly. But I think as soon as the weather turns, they'll start growing their coats a bit more. But they just have a really fine coat of fur, of wool.
What color are they?
So they're spotted almost. They're like a beige to white and brown with some Katahdins have spots. And these three range from like a off-white to a darkish brown.
And how old were they when you brought them out to Onion Creek Farm, and where did you get them?
Yeah, they were 3 months old when I brought them out. They were born in March, and I brought them out sometime in June. And I bought them from some hobby sheep farmers in Nevada, Iowa. Huh. Stacy and Carl Link. They raise Katahdins for themselves, for their own lamb, and they just love the breed and find a lot of pleasure in grazing these animals at their farm. I think they probably have about 40 acres and designated spots where the sheep can graze. And they're ram lambs. So
right.
They
so got to eat those males,
that's right?
Right.
So, yeah, there's not much else they're used for. You only need so many rams to breed. So they kept the ram they wanted for breeding, and they wanted to find a market for their other ram lambs instead of taking them to a local auction. They don't really like to sell their animals to people they don't know because they're attached to their animals. They love their sheep. And so that was another win-win. It worked out really well because I was able to buy three of them off of them. We don't need any females at the farm. It's actually best that we just have one sex instead of both, so we don't have to deal with any of that. And so I'm grazing three ram lambs.
Talk about the fencing system. Now, I must mention that I was not encouraged about sheep because I remember the other ones, and I thought, I'm not chasing sheep. I'm not chasing sheep. And they do sort of go where they want to go. So tell folks how you keep them where you want them, Megan.
Sure. Well, there has been some sheep chasing.
Some outages.
Yeah. I think Joe told me one morning he was having his coffee and he looked up and the three lambs were on the patio.
Yeah, that's true. That did happen.
Timely.
And then he called me. Yeah. But basically, we've been using electro netting, which is basically, it just looks like netting. It's white netting with small electric wires running through it, and then you can plug that into either a portable solar charger or some electric somewhere.
And how tall is the fencing?
Oh, I think the fencing is 4 feet tall.
Oh.
And it comes in movable, portable panels that are 160 feet long.
So you can bunch it up.
So you can bunch it up and take it to the next place where you want your sheep to be.
Do sheep leap over fences the way goats do?
Well, yeah. They've started leaping. These sheep are leapers. And
lambs are leaping.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, we've had pretty good luck. When the fence is hot and it's plugged in and there's a charge, that we can keep those sheep in.
And they have plenty to eat.
When they have
so
plenty
they're not bored,
to eat.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
The problem is when they kind of get bored with grasses and maybe want some more clover or something a little more nutritious for them.
On the other side
them,
of the fence,
exactly.
Yes.
Then they're not going to be afraid to just take that leap. And luckily at Joe and Lana's farm, there is a lot of perimeter fencing for their vegetables, so to keep deer out, really, and some natural barriers because it's, you know, one side is forested. So
they haven't gotten into the vegetable patch.
They have, but right now there's nothing that they want to eat besides the clover and the cover crop underneath things. So, I mean, if they would have gotten in when we had peas, new beans, lettuces, arugula, they would have kind of maybe gone to town, but they don't like what's growing
now. Is that what happened to my radicchio crop?
No, that was the woodchuck.
Oh.
But I think they would like that, too. But right now, we are coexisting quite nicely. They don't like tomatoes.
I did see them take a couple bites of kale.
Yeah, okay.
But the great thing about sheep is that they are grazers. They're not actually browsers. Like, mm-hmm. goats are browsers.
Oh,
if we had goats,
it
would be a whole different can of worms.
Yeah. Let's not get goats, okay?
Yeah. Okay. So, and sheep are actually used in vineyards in California to take care of weeds underneath all of the vines of grapes.
Because cover croppings, yes.
Exactly, because they don't really... They do some browsing, but it's not their natural inclination. So they're actually kind of good in this situation where they can kind of get rid of some of Joe's crabgrass that he hates. And
will they eat that honeysuckle that he hates?
Yes, they will, actually. Woo-hoo! So maybe that's our next place where we're going to put them to try to take care of some of that honeysuckle and maybe some black locust.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah, and they are personable sort of things. And once you learn how to dance with them... They do herd pretty well.
Exactly.
And not bad at all.
It's all about positioning yourself correctly to get them to go where you want them to go.
And Lana, how does your new puppy like the sheep?
Very well, very well. But I have been...
Farley must think they're his best play
they
friends,
are.
Right?
They are. He loves the sheep. The sheep are a little leery of him, though, which is actually pretty good.
Maybe the sheep will train him with a little kick now and then.
Yes, perhaps.
They do that, too.
Animals are amazing when you learn to work with them. Practical Farmers of Iowa has a website or a listserv that sends out, well, it's kind of a share and share alike information. I saw something this week where someone was actually looking. It was a plea. Does anybody out there have goats? Goats. I need some goats to help clean up some of my weeds. And that's a perfect use for goats.
Yeah, right. And she got very pragmatic replies. Who to call, what to do.
Exactly. Within that same day, she got about mm-hmm. four different replies, mm-hmm. and they connected her with Goats on the Go, which is a service out of Ames that leases out their goats for vegetation management. So it's just...
Vegetation management.
That's right. That's the technical term.
I like that.
Yeah. So the discussion list, so we have one focused on livestock. Other discussion lists are cover crops, field crops, horticulture, on-farm energy, policy.
Policy listserv is lots of fun.
It is, actually. Lots of heated discussion on the policy.
We got some opinions going on in our farming community.
That's right. And I'm happy to have a place to voice those opinions
on our
policy discussion list.
I must
list.
Say, I post occasionally on yes. this so since I have opinions.
How does one find this? It sounds like everything from a editorial Facebook sort of thing to a bulletin board for finding goats.
It really is. So one perk of being a Practical Farmers of Iowa member is access to these discussion lists. So this is not open to non-members, and that's very strategic on our part because we want our members to have this advantage to be able to learn from each other. That is our mission, to facilitate farmer-to-farmer exchange of knowledge, and a discussion list is a great way to do that every single day. So when you become a member of PFI, you then notify us of what discussion list you would like to be a part of.
You can pick and choose.
That's right. Exactly. Right. And you can also remove yourself from a discussion list anytime that you want. But
about the only thing that's not allowed, thankfully, is politics.
Yeah, we really shy away from political discussion.
No politics and no religion.
That's right.
That's
Which
what
I
my
think
mother
is a general rule
My mother
of thumb
used to
for...
say at the dinner table there should never be a discussion of sex, politics, or religion.
There you go.
Yeah. So, Megan, you deal with livestock management issues. Does it ever feel like herding cats? I had to ask that. Can it be hectic, or is it a pleasant, wonderful job?
Oh, for the most part, it's pleasant and wonderful because I love livestock, and I just absolutely love what our livestock members and farmers are doing.
It's farmer
for
lots
Iowa's
of fun.
Landscape, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes it can feel like herding cats. Yes, absolutely. There are times when it's just kind of wild and crazy in the
well,
office.
We have to remember farmers are entrepreneurs,
that's
as
right.
it were. Yes,
that's right. Yes.
There's lots of different possibilities and different methods and lots of things to share.
Yeah. But honestly, it's harder... It's harder herding people than it is cows. I've found that out.
Oh, yes.
So.
Cows like to be herded.
Yeah.
Very good. You are listening to KHOI. This is Community Radio. That was a little tune called The Blackberry Quadrille. Some dance music from a CD collection called Summer Tunes. Got to slide in.
Quadrille, I love that word. Quadrille.
Slide in some of those summer tunes yet. Blackberries. We've had a fine fruit year, at least I have so far. I've learned a lot about sheep from having sheep on my farm this year, and they like to eat lots of things. Just yesterday, I watched them enjoying a gooseberry bush. The berries,
oh dear.
Now, the berries were gone. The berries were gone, but they
I know,
did,
but the bush.
I know, but it was a big pickly one in
oh,
the woods.
Oh, it needed trimming.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They did a fine job. They will eat about just about anything, berries and all sorts of things. So, have you been enjoying berries, Donna?
Well, there last week or so, there was a glut of raspberries, black and red, and I bought, I think, 4 quarts or something, and just I had at it. I thought, first, I got that many because I thought, oh, well, I'll make something jelly or rah, 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 rah. But you know what? I either gave away or ate every single bit of it within 2 days.
Good for you.
I know. I made smoothies. I just kept eating and eating and, of course, picking the little seeds out of my teeth. But, you know, it's a small price to pay. They were delicious.
I think you did the fine thing. One should always eat in season. I have a little recipe here I'd like to share. Donna gave me a book here that actually must be part of a series. It's called The River Cottage Handbook Number 2.
Oh, yes. River Cottage is Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, a British not terribly young anymore, chef, but he started cooking from his farm, and he had a magnificent BBC series, and now it's launched into a cooking school and a destination and a few lovely restaurants, but the focus is always on seasonal and local, and there are a series of books written by people who worked with him. There's a mushroom book, a berry book for mm-hmm. foraging in the hedgerows, as the English mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. and this is the preserves book.
Yes, the English take on preserves is really interesting. I've gotten a lot of good ideas out of this, and I ran across this one. Yeah, elderberries kind of came and went quickly this year.
Oh, my
year.
Goodness. I didn't even see them. They were blooming, yeah, then they yeah. were green,
yeah.
and I turn around, and now they're nothing but little skeletons on the
trees. The birds have been
Whoa.
Busy.
It must have just come during all of that rainy period, because mm-hmm. they're...
Maybe when your water heater was out.
Yeah, I guess so. But, I missed the whole thing this year.
Yeah, but elderberries are lovely, and I grabbed a few. I did have a few.
They're lovely to look at.
Yes.
The taste is something that must be dealt with.
Oh, right.
Slightly better than what are those other berries? Slightly better than aronia berries.
No,
pardon
no.
my prejudice, but
but
the medicinal qualities of elderberries make it worth fighting for.
Elderberries have potential, and this is a English sort of take on elderberries. It's called Pontac, a Pontac sauce. Pontac.
Pontac.
Mm. Pontac. It's a cooking sauce. Think of it sort of like a very intensely berry-ish Worcestershire sauce or a
Oh, for like meats and
yes,
things.
Yes, for meats. Of course.
What does she say it's for?
Oh, pungent, fruity, and spicy. It is an unrivaled partner for winter stews, casseroled liver, slow-roasted belly of pork, or anything wild
casseroled
and gamey.
Casseroled liver.
Or anything wild and gamey. Besides, serving this sauce alongside meat dishes, you could add a couple tablespoons full to sauces and gravies. This has...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's... Hmm. And it is... It ages.
Don't we all?
We are. It's best used after 7 years, although you would be hard pushed to keep it. As Donna laughs. Yes.
7 years?
Well, I've got some pretty dusty stuff in my basement.
True.
I don't know, but...
It's true. Yeah. Okay. I clean out my freezer once in a while, and I go, I only wonder how this is going to taste.
But here it is. Here's the ingredients. I thought it was great. And I didn't save enough to do this. But I bet you could do this or something like it with any kind of thing.
I thawed out some blackcurrant jam from 2008, and it was fantastic.
There you go. Okay, this takes a little over a pound of elderberries, 18 fluid ounces of cider vinegar, 7 ounces of shallots, 6 cloves, 4 allspice berries,
okay.
1 blade of mace, 1 teaspoon of black peppercorns, and 15 grams, English measures, of fresh root ginger bruised.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's a ketchup equivalent.
Yes, you make it. Yeah. You actually roast the vinegar and the elderberries in an oven for a long, long time, 4 to 6 hours, and strain that, crush that up. And then the rest is simmered on the stovetop.
I wonder if you couldn't do that in a crock pot with a lid open, maybe.
You
it'd
could.
Be a little easier.
And you could actually start with something else, too. Like, I don't know, if you have some other berries in your mind, I'm sure you could. But then you bring it to a boil.
Do you think aronia berries would work?
Well,
in it?
With all this stuff in here, now I wouldn't mind. And then the sauce grows better with age. You can, after you've boiled it, put it in a sterilized jar and store in a cool, dark cupboard. Try to lay some bottles down for a few months if you can.
Lay some bottles down.
Right.
Put them in the wine cellar, maybe.
That is Pontac elderberry sauce. Yeah, there you go. Try that.
Maybe next year if I can catch the elderberries in time.
For your liver casserole.
I got to tell you, I was able to get some pig's feet finally. I have them in the freezer, and I'm going to be cooking pig's feet in the next few weeks, and there will be a live on-air report of the pig's feet cooking. Oh, joy, joy.
Well, we can look forward to that.
Oh, we have a lot to look forward to.
Megan, you said something about elderberries. What did you do with elderberries?
Yeah, well, while I was down moving sheep down by your creek, I saw some elderberries that were perfectly ripe and they needed picking. And I knew if I didn't pick them then, the birds would get them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked those and filled a 5-gallon bucket. And then I got back into town and my neighbor told me that I should be walking down all the alleys in town because there's other elderberry bushes that haven't
grown wild.
So I got some more.
Oh, urban foraging. There you go.
Did some urban foraging. And basically I shook off and combed off all of the berries from the cluster they were hanging on and rinsed them really well. And then put them in mason jars and added some sort of alcohol that is over 40%, 40 proof, basically.
So you used straight vodka or something unflavored?
I had some cane sugar vodka or rum.
Oh, white lightning kind of thing.
Yeah. And then I bought a bottle of Everclear, and I just filled 3 bottles up to the top. And
no sugar?
No sugar. And we're going to see what happens. Elderberry tincture. Wait 6 to 8 weeks.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It'll be a tincture.
So the point of elderberry tincture is in the middle of the winter when you feel like you're coming down with a cold.
That's right.
Who knows if the cure comes from the alcohol or from the elderberries?
Who knows?
It's all good.
It doesn't matter.
It's all good. Yes, yes. Whatever.
And if you put sugar in it, you can feed it to the children.
Yeah, right.
Yes, it is. Good. So, Megan, are there Practical Farmers of Iowa field days yet to come?
Yes, there
sure
are.
The whole schedule.
I believe that there are 8 total still to come, and there are 4 livestock field days still happening. Coming up next week, we're having a livestock marketing and stockmanship school, so it's actually not really a field day. It's more of this intensive workshop, but it's 4 days.
For what kind of livestock?
Mostly cattle, or sheep, but they're going to...
So, mostly beef?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, beef cattle. Mm-hmm. They're going to talk about low-stress animal handling.
I like the sound of that.
Yes, yes.
I bet it's low stress for the farmer, too.
That's right. Low stress for both animal and farmer.
Because if you're stressing out your animals, it's usually a lot more work.
Yeah, and we're going to learn from the pros in the country, Tina Williams and Richard McConnell. Tina is Bud Williams' daughter, and Bud Williams is a renowned animal handler and animal behaviorist.
Farm celebrities, right?
Yes.
Good. Yeah,
yes,
wow.
They are. And they're coming to Iowa, which is really exciting. And we have about 20 farmers that are going to attend.
Good.
So that's coming up. And then we have a field day in late September on the 28th and another on October 15th that are focusing on grass finishing cattle.
Oh, wow. Meat quality. Good idea.
So this is a 2-part field day series, which is a really interesting idea. So the first field day, we're actually going to look at 4 live beef cows in the field. And we're going to talk about their muscling and what they look like, because we have used an ultrasound machine to actually clue us in on their muscle quality. Mm-hmm. So we're going to look at them in the field, and then 2 weeks later we're going to actually go to a slaughterhouse and see their carcasses hanging so we can actually grade their carcasses.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yes.
Oh,
so
my
where
goodness.
Can we find more information? Give your website.
Yes, please visit www.practicalfarmers.org for all of this information.
Great. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Thanks to Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa. We talked about lifestyle.
Yeehaw. Oh, boy.
Yeah, lots of stuff going on. And
even more than we could have talked about. Go to the Practical Farmers website. We're lucky to have this organization in Iowa.
Thank you.
Robotic milking for cows and elderberries. There you go. And wait, sheep. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen Tuesdays at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. or anytime at khoifm.org. Stream, go to the website, support this fine community radio station. We're all in this together. My name is Lana Noxico.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food, enjoy life.